Alex, I believe I have reached the equivalent of nirvana.
Tell me more.
Well, I have been sleeping on my cozy earth sheets.
Wow.
And when I get up in the morning, I put on my fantastic jogger suit.
Yes.
Which is a funny way to put it, but you started saying that, so I'm just going to keep on going. And it is opening my mind to things I didn't know I could open my mind to.
Casey, all I have to say is, welcome to the other side.
It's incredible, Alex.
I've lived two lives. One of them is before Cozy Earth, and one is after.
Which is right now.
That's right. We're talking Cozy Earth. They make incredible, soft, lovely, temperature-controlled bedding and cozy wear.
Cozy Earth makes the best clothes I think I've ever touched, that have ever touched my skin.
Casey, I'm right there with you.
It's soft, it's breathable, it's temperature regulated, it looks good, it feels good, which makes it good.
And how about this for good? All of their products come with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. So if for some completely batshit reason you don't love these sheets, you can return them.
Now, Alex, right around the corner is Mother's Day. If you haven't already done something, which you should have,
yeah,
now's your moment. Go buy your mom some Cozy Earth, because it is the thing that will help her sleep at night. It's the thing that will help keep her comfortable at all moments of her life. And that's what you want for your mom.
So she isn't up all night thinking about what a disappointment her children are.
Exactly, because they didn't get her Cozy Earth. You don't want to be on that level.
Well, Casey, here's some exciting news. All Completely Arbitrary listeners get 35% off at CozyEarth.com with promo code TREES. Again, that's promo code TREES, T-R-E-E-S, for 35% off at Cozy Earth. So get yourself cozy. Get your mom cozy. Hell, get your dad cozy and your friends cozy.
Yeah, it doesn't have to stop there, you know?
Make the earth cozy with Cozy Earth.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What's up, Fungal Associates? Welcome to Completely Arbitrary. This is the podcast about trees and other related topics. I am one of your hosts. My name is Alex Croson. And as always, I am here with Mr. K.C. Clapp.
Hello, everyone.
Now, I worry when I say K.C. Clapp, people will think your name is like initials K.C.
Oh, yeah, it's not.
But your name is Casey.
Yeah. Spelled with a C, an A, an S, an E, and a Y. I am K.C. Clapp. Yes, just the normal spelled out. Let's say the OG version.
Sure.
Is that OG, you think? Was Casey invented before people called other people by the acronym, or rather the initials KC?
I don't know, because I feel like in the 1800s, it was very common to have two initials for your first name.
Oh, yeah. J.P. Pritchard.
Yeah, something like that. And I wonder if that's like an emphasis on family name, you know?
Oh, yeah, right? I don't know. That's an interesting point. Like, what was the convention then?
Yeah, it could be an interesting topic for somebody's Wikipedia rabbit hole.
It's a gender-neutral name of Irish and Scottish Gaelic origin.
Oh, there you go.
Mm-hmm, there you go.
Well, Casey, I could talk about your name all day.
Let's steer into that, Alex.
But
what?
We got to talk about a tree today. In fact, we are talking about more than a tree. We're talking about a tree, an idea, and a man. And the tree is incense cedar.
That's right. The incense cedar.
How exciting.
It is. It's very exciting. I do have, I'll tell you about it later. I have a confession to make about it.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Well, consider this your teaser.
Yeah. Sorry, everyone.
And today is part two of our conservation preservation talk, in which we will be talking about preservation. And more specifically, we'll be talking about the man who started it all. Sure, let's journalize it a little. The man who started it all, John Muir.
Yeah.
But that discussion has to come after a break. We'll be right back with Completely Arbitrary. Casey, you know our future is bright.
Yeah, it is, Alex.
But it's so bright, we gotta wear shades.
What?
Casey and I are now putting on our gooder glasses.
Oh, man, I can't see a damn thing.
Hey, they do the job, huh?
These things are great.
Casey, that's right. This episode is brought to you by Gooder.
That sure is right.
That is G-O-O-D-R. They make fashionable sunnies.
They make fantastic sunglasses. Alex, I got a quick story. When they approached us, I said, I cannot tell you how excited I am about this. They saved me when I was riding my bike across Iowa in Ragbri last July.
Wow.
I couldn't see. I got hit in the eye. So one of my eyes from a week prior would not constrict. It was constantly dilated.
Oh my God.
So I had to wait till it like essentially refixed itself. I ended up needing to wear sunglasses on the entire drive and driving back over, but I had cheap gas station sunglasses.
Yeah.
It was $5 or something.
Yeah.
And they just did not do the job. I was absolutely in hell. And then stopped over at a shop that was there and then picked up a pair of sunglasses and it said it was $25. And I was like, what? These are okay. I'll try them out. I just need a new pair.
Yeah.
All polarized. I put them on my face and it was like the world had changed.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure I cried, Alex.
Casey,
like, I love these sunglasses.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. They saved me.
That's amazing, Casey. And they didn't save me yet.
The time will come.
The day will come when I need these glasses and I have them. I do love these sunglasses, Casey. And I was telling you before we started recording, my problem with sunglasses is that I always either buy, like you said, a cheap gas station pair for $6, or I could debase myself by spending $200 on a pair of sunglasses at Nordstrom or some shit. I ain't doing that. Casey, Gooder are the perfect middle ground.
They sure are. Starting at $25, they're all 100% polarized. You can look into water and see through it.
Oh my God.
Which is incredible.
Is that true?
It is. They're polarized.
Yeah. Oh, well,
the
these,
glare
would be great
goes
for,
away.
These would be great for fishing, eh?
Exactly.
And they would be great for cycling, working out, golfing, going to the beach, hiking, or just walking around town.
Just doing anything. I rode my bike across Iowa with these sunglasses. People wear them while they are jogging. They stay on your face. They don't bounce. They are excellently made. I cannot recommend Gooder enough.
And Casey, they're pretty cool. In fact, you and I got a couple pairs.
Oh, yeah. What did you get?
Mine are called Hellhound Hallucinations.
Ooh, Alex, I got The Future is Void.
Amazing.
Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar, that's the name of our sunglasses.
Yes.
Not our new catchphrases for Completely Arbitrary.
Hey, man, you know what I say. Hellhound Hallucinations.
Yeah, he does say that.
And if you want to support this show and try a pair of Gooder, they are giving Completely Arbitrary listeners free shipping. You can go to gooder.com/trees. That's GOODR.com/trees and use code trees for free shipping. Gooder offers a 30-day money-back guarantee and 100% satisfaction. Again, that's gooder.com/trees and use code trees for free shipping. We'll see you in the future.
Which is void.
And bright.
Yeah, you look good. You look good.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary. Today we're talking the incense cedar. In our part two on conservation and preservation, this is preservation, Casey.
That's right, Alex.
Oh, I ran out of air there.
Are you okay? Do you need to take a breath?
Yeah. Well, Casey, today we're talking incense cedar.
That's right, Alex.
So let's imagine that you and I are walking through...
Oh, yeah, where do you want us?
Like a crystal shop in Portland.
Oh, interesting.
And we come across the incense section.
And then I say, Alex, did you know there's a tree named about this?
There's a tree based on this incense. Casey, let's ID this tree.
Let's do it, Alex. So this is a tree that is close to my heart. I think that it's close to my heart for a couple different reasons. One, I think it's gorgeous. B, it's like kind of underplanted. Mm. It's getting more and more planted every now and then. But it's kind of like one of those things where you don't, it's not like wildly popular, but it's not unknown.
Sure.
So whenever you see it, you're just kind of like, oh, hey, all right, cool, that's great.
I've certainly heard of it.
Yeah.
But I'm not like, it's not in the zeitgeist, I would say.
Yes, yeah. But it's not out of the zeitgeist.
It's just it's a fringe zeitgeist tree.
Exactly. But at the same time, you can't tell which fringe it's on. Is it on the inside of the fringe or on the outside of the fringe?
It doesn't exist.
Nobody knows, Alex. So it's a tree that's native to this lovely place we call home, Oregon.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It is. In fact, you can drive out to the out Highway 26 towards Mount Hood.
Mm-hmm.
And as you just get over the crest and start going back down beyond both of the passes that you go through, there's a turnoff that goes down towards a town called Maupin. It kind of goes essentially due east from the east side of Mount Hood, and Highway 26 continues kind of further south, southeast.
Okay. Toward Bend and such.
Exactly, yes. And this is the northern extent of the population of it. And I just drove that drive maybe couple weeks ago.
That drive. I'll just drove that drive.
And we did it. I found a bunch of eucalypts. Sorry, all of our Australian listeners. You're probably so upset. So you can go right past the northern limit of where you find these trees. Now, the incense cedar, in this instance, is on the east side of the Cascades. And as you kind of go south past Mount Jefferson, it kind of starts to come further to the west side because everything kind of continually gets drier. And then as you go south towards the Siskiyous, its range really widens and it starts growing in the Klamath Mountains and the Siskiyou Mountains all the way through central and eastern central California.
Oh, wow.
In all those drier kind of mountain ranges around that central valley.
That's quite a range.
It is a significantly ranged tree.
Wow.
And interestingly, it grows kind of, it represents this interesting kind of cross-section of all of the trees in the area, all the forest types, I guess. So all the way down the very south, it grows near the giant sequoias. Way high elevation in the Sierra Nevada mountains, and it's just kicking it.
Mm.
Then as it goes north, certain trees kind of drop away. You don't get the big cone Douglas fir anymore. You don't really get your giant sequoias. Then you grow up a little bit higher, and now it's growing with red firs and the kind of Southern Californian variety of white fir. And then, as you continually go north, it becomes a part of the Siskiyou kind of flora and fauna, where you get Jeffrey pine and a couple other different species. The red fir transitions to noble fir, and then it continues up. And now you start getting with the larches and your Douglas firs and all these other like kind of changes that happen in the forest. Apparently, the incense cedar just doesn't really care. It just keeps on growing.
That tracks for its personality that I garner from it.
Oh, you okay? Yeah,
I think so. It's pretty chill.
It is. It's pretty chill, but it also like just doesn't. It's not a tree that's going to like necessarily dominate the forest.
Yeah,
but it's not going to be a minor constituent. You know?
Okay, it's like a major supporting character.
Yes, it is the Brendan Fraser of trees.
Well, I was kidding. Okay, yes.
It's the best B-list tree you've ever seen.
It's like a Jabba the Hutt, like iconic, but he's really only in the movie for like 20 minutes.
I guess that's true. All right, yeah.
By the way, I'm so sorry. Before we go on.
Pardon me.
Calocedrus decurrens.
Oh, wow. Did we just skip over
we
that?
We did.
Like
that
a
is
bunch
the,
of dunces.
That is the binomial, the scientific Latin name
that
for
is
this
true.
Tree.
So that, of course, means beautiful cedar. Did you know that?
I didn't, but I love that.
There you go.
Love it indeed. And it is, Casey. It's a good looking tree.
And why is it good looking? Well, it is the morphology, as we are now talking about. So this is a quintessential cedar tree. It's in the cedar family, in the cypress family, and it grows up to be a large, large tree. It can get over about 150, near probably 200 feet tall, but not 100% the tallest tree that you're going to find in a forest. It gets really big and massive, like really huge. I think some of the things I've seen have been like upwards of 12 feet in diameter, maybe 10, ooh, like really big trees. Certainly the ones that I have seen.
Damn.
And their bark is really gorgeously red, a very common false cypress, false cedar kind of thing. Anything in that cypress family, they tend to have that kind of fibrous reddish looking bark.
This is a false cedar, you said.
Correct. This is in the cypress family. It is not a true cedar, which is in the genus Cedrus.
Right, right, right.
And it grows with this kind of, it's a very upright tree, but its foliage kind of hangs vertically almost, but also erect. And this is hard for me to kind of describe because it has branches and twigs that have scale-like leaves. So you don't see like twig and leaf. They're all kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yet they kind of like come out almost either swept up or they're held vertically. So that your branches and your twigs kind of create this sweepy looking appearance. Does that kind of make sense?
I think so.
Can I see what I'm talking about?
To me, it sort of looks like like it's holding a bunch of pom poms.
Oh yeah,
like these curved sort of branches that curve up a little bit. And then there's like a big bushel of foliage at the
interesting.
End.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, but what I kind of would insist on including is that the pom poms themselves are not rounded. They're not like poofs, you know? Like they're made up of flattened sprays that then create this pom-pom effect.
Sure.
Does that track?
I got you.
Yeah. So they're really gorgeous in that regard because they have this kind of fantastic texture. They look very pillowy, very cloud-like.
To me, they just have a very like Western look.
Oh,
they look
yeah.
like a Western tree.
That is perfect. It's a quintessential kind of Western tree.
Yeah.
Especially because it also grows amongst all these other Western trees.
Mm.
You name it. If it grows in this kind of middle Cascade, Upper Sierra area, this tree also grows with it.
Cool.
Like almost to a T. So as you get a little bit closer, you'll notice that the individual needles are in bundles. I shouldn't say bundles because that is misleading.
Like a pine bundle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They are in groups of four.
Okay.
But because they're in that cedar cypress family, false cedar cypress family, they're oppositely arranged. So they have two oppressed scale-like leaves on the top and then two on the side.
Oh, yeah. So going down the little stem.
Yeah.
It's like, what do we call that? It's like perpendicular.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Scales appear opposite, perpendicular down the stem.
Yes. And the term for that in botany is decusset.
Decusset.
Yes.
I've heard that before.
We've talked about it in a few different trees, I believe, specifically probably other cedar trees.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And the thing about this kind of fashion of the tree is that it makes it look a lot like other trees that are also false cypresses. Your Western red cedar, your Port Orford cedar, that type of tree.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth other one that we really have in the Great Pacific Northwest is the Alaska yellow cedar.
Hmm.
So they're all very closely related in that they're in the cypress family. But the big difference between this and those, our incense cedar and the other false cedars, is that they have lighter green foliage, and the foliage on the sides, those kind of lateral scales, they kind of pop out a little bit, and then the next ones are nested kind of within that.
Hmm.
So they kind of look like they resemble a like stemmed wine glass or something like that.
Interesting.
That then is stacked on top of one another all the way down the stem. So they have these like little flares that look like these little cups,
cool.
which I think are really fun.
Interesting.
Now those scales are pressed to the little twigs and then they grow out and they don't turn brown at all in the wintertime. I only bring this up because the Western red cedar tends to do this, where in winter, the green evergreen leaves kind of get a bit of a brownish, orangish tone to them.
Casey, Let's move on from the needles because I feel like we've been talking about them for 10 minutes.
I could talk about them forever.
It's just fine. But I really want to talk about the cone.
I love that.
The cone is really cute.
It is. It's cute and it is silly. It's silly because it doesn't look like what you'd expect for a cone.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it is. It is the most adorable cone description also. And it took me a long time to like kind of understand how people were referring to it, but they would always call it a duckbill cone.
Totally.
And okay, you see this right off the bat?
Absolutely.
What, describe it to me and tell me what it is. Like, when, at what point is this cone like a duck's bill?
Well, I'm also comparing it to my hands now. I'm putting my hands up as if to be in prayer.
Yes.
With a little space between them.
You
do. Right?
You look like you have like a little golf ball in your hands.
Yeah, I'm holding my hands together, but I have a golf ball in my palms.
Yes, right before you pray to the golf gods.
That I make the shot. So if you open up your hands at the wrist, there might be like a single. Okay, hold on. I'm backing up. I'm backtracking.
You see?
No. I can do this. It's like a cone. Like a normal cone.
Yeah.
With like two scales.
Okay,
and those scales are on the outside and they kind of hinge open.
Yeah.
And it looks like there are probably four seeds in it.
I'm not sure actually. I haven't seen exactly how many seeds are in each scale.
Okay. I would assume that there are two in each scale and there appear to be two scales. Maybe there are more. But it just sort of opens like a book instead of like say a pine species cone, which has many little seats around this little coliseum where seeds sit.
Yeah.
This is just like a book that opens and seeds fall out.
There you go. I think that's fair. That's accurate.
When it's closed, it's sort of the shape of like a mango.
Oh,
or an avocado.
I've always thought of an almond.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
But specifically the thing that we eat, almond, not the actual fruit, which doesn't look anything like this.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is the actual almond itself.
So it's almond-shaped cone.
Yeah. So, okay, perfect. I seed. It does look like a duck's bill. But it's one of those things, whenever I described it, like, yeah, it looks like duck bill, I just kind of blindly said whatever somebody else said to me without actually considering, like, what does a duck's bill look like?
Well, it only looks like a duck's bill when it's open.
Yes.
When it's closed, it just looks like an almond.
So that is what the cone looks like. I adore it. This is also a tree that has pollen cones that are just about now getting ready to release their pollen. They release their pollen in the middle of winter. So if you are in, say, January, February, I think it looks like they're getting ready. I saw a bunch earlier. Like right now, true cedars, Chenus cedrus, they're just now letting their pollen cones go.
Really?
Yeah, so they're getting warmed up. They're getting ready to go. They do it in the wintertime.
They pollinate in the wintertime?
Yes, by the wind.
How wacky.
Yeah, very wacky. Now, as these cones open up, as you noted, they kind of open up and they look almost like two-sided bells or something that drop out these adorable little seeds.
Mm-hmm.
They then will fall to the ground and kind of cover the ground. They're very hard and woody. You're not going to find them kind of like easy and look like cones. You can kind of go, oh, look at that. That's a cone. It's going to look like some weird appendage that's fallen off.
Oh, weird.
Then you can notice them hanging up there. There'll be some that are hanging that are spent, some that are hanging that are new for the next year. They'll be littering the ground underneath. And you will notice again the gorgeous bark. The thing about the bark of the incense cedar is that the incense cedar's bark is furrowy and fibrousy and reddish, brownish all at the same time.
Hmm.
So they are very fire adapted species. They have this big thick bark and fire can come over and get all around it and it's not going to hurt the tree. Okay. Now, Alex, this tree grows in some places that I love to visit.
Hmm.
Specifically, it grows in some wilderness areas down in southern Oregon, northern California, and national parks throughout the same space.
Talking like the Klamath region?
Exactly.
Okay.
There are many of these growing in one of my favorite places to visit, which is the Rogue Umpqua Divide Wilderness.
Wow.
There are also some in an area called the Red Buttes Wilderness. And that is in northern California and southern Oregon. They also grow in the Siskiyous, in the Siskiyou Wilderness, the Kalmiopsis Wilderness, and other wilderness areas in this area that I don't even know about. Marble Mountain wilderness. I've also seen them in the Russian wilderness.
Ah, yes.
Well, so you'll notice, Sir Alex, that all of these places... Oh, I should also note, there are some other wilderness, quote, wilderness areas that we call national parks.
Yeah.
Yosemite National Park, Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Park, and... I think actually you might be able to find some of these trees in Lassen Volcanic National Park. I think it's something like that is what it's called.
Well, Casey, what do all these places have in common?
Well, Alex, all these places have in common is that they are preserved wilderness areas.
Ah, there's the rub.
Interesting question, sir. So the house, I also need, this is my confession.
Oh, wow.
I racked my brain to try to find a really good tree that I could use as an example of what we're talking about today.
Right.
And every single one I came up with, we've already covered.
Oh, wow.
The white bark, or the white bark pine. Great example of a tree that we are trying to preserve. We've already done it.
Right.
The bristlecone pines, the sequoias, the redwoods, done them.
So is the incense cedar kind of not one of those trees that we're trying desperately to preserve?
Yes.
You know what, Casey? I think that's okay.
this is going to be an example of us saying, hey, so here's a tree, and now we're going to talk about something that is related to it.
It's pretty broadly related, but you know what we'll do?
It's pretty broadly related. We're going to give me a chance to really sell it.
Don't worry about that.
Oh, thanks,
I don't want you to be nervously trying to tie a bow on this whole thing.
All right.
It's good that you bring it up early on. Say, you know what? This episode really isn't about the incense cedar.
Temper your expectations here, people.
You always should temper your expectations.
Yeah, you should. Don't give us too much here. So these places, as you so sagely asked, are all wilderness areas.
Okay.
In a technical sense.
Wilderness preserve, I've heard that term.
Yes, and that's fair. Wilderness preserve, I think, it's a bit of an old-fashioned term.
Oh,
you know?
Interesting.
We don't really use the term preserve anymore.
Okay.
Like, it is more of a designated means. A space preserves something. It can also be a preserve or a preservation, but there's not really a preservation, like a reservation,
yeah.
You know? So it's kind of an old-fashioned term.
Okay.
But it does work. The idea being that you have something that is being preserved in perpetuity in some form.
Okay.
It's the broadest way I can kind of describe
it. Okay. So with no plans of like... by in perpetuity, you basically mean like there's no future plans to like harvest anything from this area. It's just like until further notice, this is a protected space. Don't do anything with it.
Exactly. You can walk through it. You can look at it and that's it. So you'll recall last time we talked about the idea of conservation and you came up with, without anybody like saying, hey, Alex, say this.
This is true.
You'd exactly describe conservation versus preservation.
Yes.
Can you give us a real quick roundup of what you said?
I would love to. So conservation is when you have a nature area and you say, we want to harvest this area for its natural resources, the trees, for wood. But we don't just want to cut them all down and move on to the next place and forget about it. We want to replant these trees. We want to conserve this land while still harvesting its goods.
Yeah.
Preservation is saying, no. You don't even harvest the land. You just protect it.
Yeah.
For its own sake. It has intrinsic value beyond wood, right?
Yes. Perfect. It is the use of by and for humans as opposed to... just not really.
Existing because it has a right to exist.
Yeah, exactly. And this was the idea of conservation was really championed by the character we introduced last time, Gifford Pinchot.
Gifford
Pinchot, which is a funny thing where the guy's name is actually just two last names. You know, like there's people with two first names.
Yeah.
He's two last names.
That is interesting.
Yeah. Kathy Gifford Pinchot. I love that. I love Natalie Portmanteau's.
Jesus Christ.
Anyway, So Gifford Pinchot, he's kind of famous for being the first leader of the brand new National Forest Service.
Yes.
Which is underneath, and this should make a lot more sense to everyone now, the Department of Agriculture.
Mm.
So the USDA Forest Service. Why ever would this be underneath the agriculture place, underneath the people who are actively managing land for growing food, for growing crops, for harvesting things?
Because we are managing this land to harvest things, and those things are trees.
Exactly. Or, broadly speaking, natural resources.
Okay, so the forestry, does that include, like, mining for coal and shit?
Yeah, or just whatever things happen to be there. Maybe you just need a mine for a certain kind of rock that is, you know, used in gravel. Maybe it's a certain kind of ore that has uranium in it or something like that. You know, there's lots of different individual ores and mines and gems and things that we use that are fundamentally rocks, right?
Yeah.
So underneath the very first kind of description of what the Forest Service did, you had Gifford Pinchot saying, well, essentially, our job is to manage the natural resources of the nation for, quote, the greatest good for the greatest number for the longest time.
For the greatest good for the greatest number for the longest time.
Yes.
This was Gifford.
This is Gifford. This is old Pinchot.
Got it.
And it's a really good, like, that's fundamentally a nice idea, don't you think?
Yeah.
The whole idea is saying, yeah, we're going to use these natural resources. But the issue is, by saying these are natural resources, you have some built-in assumptions and some built-in kind of predications on it, where the built-in assertion there is that it is a resource, right? So if something is a resource, it must be a resource for something, which means it's the nation's natural resources, which means that it's our nation's resources for us to use.
And I think because you and I have a tree podcast, people assume that you and I are like hardcore preservationists.
They very, very potentially are.
But it's been said before, you and I are both pro logging. Like, if it's done responsibly, it is a renewable resource.
Exactly.
As long as we keep planting trees responsibly after we log them, we're not going to run out.
I'm so happy you brought that up, because that's essentially us saying we are conservationists.
Yeah.
Which is something we also brought up last week as a funny thing that all the intense Republican strategists have also said. Republicans are conservationists, not preservationists.
Right.
And that is because the use of the natural resources is a good thing. It is something that we need to function as a society. 100% agreed. Now, I don't think that Gifford Pinchot would disagree with the idea of preservation, and I don't think that the new character we're introducing today, which probably needs no introduction, John Muir, would be against conservation. It's more of a matter of scale. So conservation, Alex, that you that we just kind of discussed, that is, yes, let's use our natural resources, but it would be, according to Gifford Pinchot, something more on the European side of it, where every bit of their land, essentially, if it's accessible, is used for making forests, for managing as a crop or as something that is being used for and by people.
Even a place that wasn't originally a forest?
Yeah, exactly. They would say, hey, well, you know what? This is not very good land for growing this crop, so let's just plant it as trees, and then, boom, we can cut that down.
Okay.
But they also manage their forest very specifically to say, well, we have this forest. We need to take out only a certain amount of wood and grow a certain amount of wood to replace what we're taking on this kind of schedule so that we know we always have it.
Yeah.
And we here in the United States have forestry schools. I have a degree in forestry. And the whole
you
idea,
do?
I do, Alex. A lot of people don't know this about me. I got a degree in forest management.
One of your 6 degrees?
Well, yes. I do have them on my wall. Through this degree, I learned lots about how we manage forests, essentially for, I've always just said we manage forests for money, which is really what we do. It's what it all boils down to.
Sure.
But on the other side of that coin, you could say, no, we're managing it for the natural resource that is wood. So what we would do in the United States, according to Gifford Pinchot, is we would use all of the resources out there, all the forests, in order to turn them into wood that we can then use and create an economy and have all the wood in the world that we could ever need to run our country.
Mm.
Superstar, big thumbs up. Let's make it happen. But where these two differed is that Gifford Pinchot would say, conservation, let's use it. That's what it's there for. Muir would say, there are some places that we should not touch at all.
Sure.
So then he started talking about the idea of preservation.
Mm.
Now, Gifford Pinchot is kind of an interesting character. He is Scottish born, came over to the United States and moved to California and started going out and created this his own kind of land ethic, his own kind of experience with nature based on religion. He was a Presbyterian. Now, he would kind of change more of what his religion was to say that this is God's creation and it's perfect and beautiful and it should exist. So he kind of had this... He kind of mixed his religion into a religion of nature.
Whereas the traditional, like, I'll also just say Christian idea behind nature, or biblical idea behind nature,
mm-hmm.
is that we have dominion over it.
Exactly. It's there to be used.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting.
So he also was a huge proponent of protecting wilderness areas. And that is where these two people came together with like both immense kind of ethical ideas of how the land should be used and managed. So Muir specifically was all about Yosemite, the Yosemite Valley. Now the Yosemite Valley is famous because it is in, of course, Yosemite National Park. The only reason Yosemite is a national park is because John Muir was like, this needs to be a national park.
Wow.
And he wrote a bunch of articles about it and sent it out and got Congress to say, oh, yes, you're a national park now.
He does strike me as an essayist.
Yes, yeah, he does. He has quite a bit of writing under his name. And he also, I should say that this national park used to be a state park in California before it was then turned into this like next level. And one of the things that was included in this national park is still to this day is a second valley that very few people know about.
Hmm.
This is the valley called Hetch Hetchy, the Hetch Hetchy Valley.
Hetch Hetchy.
Yeah, you ever heard of it?
I have.
Yes.
Is this where the big rock face is?
No. That's all in the Yosemite Valley. You're thinking El Capitan or Half Dome, those things? Yeah, that's all in the Yosemite Valley. Now, the Yosemite Valley and the Hetch Hetchy Valley are essentially the same valley. One's just a little bit further north, and they both are underneath, or rather between, these big, giant granite cliffs.
Wow.
And those giant granite cliffs have this river, I believe it's called the Merced River or something like that. So these two valleys are inside of the national park. The reason that most people don't know a lot about Hetch Hetchy is that Hetch Hetchy is no longer a valley that can be accessed. It is a reservoir behind a dam.
Oh.
Inside of our national park. Now, a reservoir is wonderful for plenty of reasons. People can use that lake as a lake, and they can mess around with it, and usually it is held... The water is held back for a couple different reasons. The first being power generation. You want to build a dam so that you can then have hydropower. The dam holds back the water. The water then builds up pressure and it goes through turbines and it spins and now you have electricity.
Mm-hmm.
You also want to hold back water for flood control. If the Willamette River here in the Willamette Valley in Oregon has like 13 dams, like some crazy amount of dams
really?
On the river, especially as you go further down and it splits into one or two different individual forks. Those have their own dams on it.
I'm thinking like Oregon City. There's a dam in Oregon City, right?
There is not a dam in Oregon City. Okay. That's just the falls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we did build a giant paper mill on it and move the water around, and now there's a locks there so that you can get up to the next level, but it's not dammed.
Okay.
Yeah, the dams on the Willamette River are way further down, like beyond Roseburg kind of thing.
Oh, okay. Like
further down.
Got it.
Now, these dams are put there for flood control so that we can essentially keep track of how much water is going through the river at any point in time, release some, hold back some, and meter it out so that down here in Portland and the rest of the valley, we're not going to get inundated by floodwaters without us knowing.
Because as I recall, the Willamette Valley at one point was like a floodplain.
Yes.
And during the winter would just get like a giant lake. And then dry out during the summer.
Exactly. Now, it wouldn't be so cut and dry. There's definitely a channel where the river would be flowing, but it would overflow its banks very often and come back. So it wasn't that the whole valley was one giant lake. It's very, very wide valley. But it would be big enough that the valley would, that the river itself would overflow its banks and become much wider and then go back down. Then go wide, then go back down. So another reason to have a dam is for water to drink. And this is why Hetch Hetchy was made in the first place. That was the biggest reason, is that San Francisco, this adorable little town on the coast, needed more water. So they, San Francisco, wanted all this water because at the time they had kind of a very old-fashioned water system where they're like getting it from certain lakes and streams and areas that were around their city and further north, but it didn't have access to enough water for the size that the city was becoming. And it was becoming very unsanitary.
Okay.
So they said, hey, there's this beautiful valley that we could use and put a dam on it and turn it into a great, great reservoir for our use. And that is the upper Hetch Hetchy Valley that's in Yosemite National Park.
There you go.
So in the early 1800s, some people said, hey, let's put a dam right on this river in the middle of this national park. And everyone, read John Muir, was like, hell no. What the hell are you talking about? This is a preserved landscape. It's not to be used. It's to be preserved exactly how it is.
So this was after that legislation had gone through.
Yes, this is after. In fact, this is some 20 or 30 years after the whole area was turned into a national park.
Okay.
All that to say, the John Muirs of the world would say national parks and preservation area. The conservationists, the Gifford Pinchos, would say national forests. Use those. Make use of them for whatever reason. And this is ultimately where you can trace the two lines of this kind of idea or these two ethics down is to this exact issue in Hetch Hetchy.
Wow.
With this whole area.
Ooh, this is like the catalyst of this whole thing.
Yes, exactly.
Cool. I like this. It's this is like a movie, Casey.
You could make this into a movie. In fact, as I was typing up my notes, I was like, why hasn't no one made this into a movie? So this is, you're exactly right, where this is like this big crux of like, who is going to be doing what, which way are the people going to go?
Yeah.
And I believe, and I know this from reading things about Gifford Pinchot, he would not want the just wanton destruction of our forests. His whole point was keep them for as long as we can for the greatest number of people, for the greatest good, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, he was actually like a voice of reason in a world where people were just like cutting and burning and moving on.
Yes, and last week you talked about there's a spectrum where you have the John Muirs on one side, you have the insane, just money-grubbing barons, capitalists on the other side, and then you had this voice of reason, this conservationist in the middle.
Yeah.
Totally agree with that sentiment. And the side that I think is really interesting here is the John Muir has this ethic that is kind of problematic in two ways. One is John Muir always imagined wilderness as untouched, unmolested, unaffected by civilization.
Casey put air quotes around that.
I did, because he was talking about white man's civilization.
Right.
White man's civilization was different than Native Americans, but also Native Americans were still humans and they shouldn't be in a wilderness area. So his wilderness idea, his ideal that he had in his brain is these two different sides. Your preservation of untrammeled land, which is literally in the Wilderness Act. It's land untrammeled by humans is
untrammeled.
The exact term.
Okay. Yeah.
Why do they choose these dumb words?
Not,
I don't know.
Not trampled.
No, trammeled.
Trammeled.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that is just innately wrong right off the cusp. Because in Hetch Hetchy specifically, there were plenty of people that lived there. The Paiutes and Miwok Indians, those tribes live there either year round. Well, not in Hetch Hetchy. Hetch Hetchy is actually too cold, and there's a little tiny outlet for the river, so it would then often get too wide and you couldn't get up into the valley.
Mm.
Great place to have a dam, by the way. Tiny little outlet, little tiny dam, big wide reservoir area in the back.
So Muir was even against like native peoples living on the land with the land.
Yeah. Well, he basically got there and started hanging around by the time these people were kind of kicked out.
Mm.
Because in 1849, you'll recall, there was a giant gold rush.
Yes.
Famous because of the American football team, the 49ers of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So that is 1849. All these things that we're talking about happened later in the maybe 1880s, 1890s, and 70s, all through into the early 1900s when the dam was actually made.
Okay.
So the native peoples that lived there started to get kicked out when all these other different people would come up and start maybe ranching in the valley. They would bring their sheep into the Hetch Hetchy Valley, and the sheep would just go around and eat almost everything.
Mm.
In fact, I believe Muir called sheep furry locusts or something like that. Maybe hoofed locusts.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So he didn't like anything in there. He saw it very much as nature at its most perfect. Without any humans.
That's pretty radical.
Yeah, especially for the time, right?
Especially for the time. And I think I've kind of romanticized John Muir from the little I know about him.
Most people have.
But now I'm like, well, that's a little far.
Yeah, and you know, and he was not a perfect person. There's a book that we actually got sent by Patagonia. At the very beginning, it opens up and talks about John Muir, and it says a note about John Muir. And they say, hey, this is a good guy. He had these great ideas, and we laud him for that. But at the same time, he had these mixed ideas about Native Americans. Sometimes he would be like, yeah, Native Americans, they're the perfect people. They live with nature. Then other times he'd be like, eh, you guys can just kind of get out of here, and we can have this. This will just be nice and protected.
But he was he maybe didn't say that out of racism. He thought that about everybody.
Yeah, I think that would be a fair description.
Okay,
because they would be using the land for their own good, and the way they have for thousands and thousands of years.
Yeah, he didn't say, "You indigenous people move out so that we white people can move in." He just said, you guys move out. Okay, now it's perfect.
And now, exactly. Now we're just going to protect it the way it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's kind of the first issue.
But still.
That's the first issue that kind of comes with this idea of preservation.
Yeah.
And this is the idea of kind of, if we bring it back up to our modern day, what are we exactly preserving?
Mm.
You know? So which time are we preserving it in or for or as?
What?
So everything is always always based on time. Was that too confusing?
Yeah.
Well, damn it.
Sorry.
The idea, Alex, is whenever we're preserving something,
mm-hmm.
we're preserving it as it is,
uh-huh.
or as we think it should be.
At a certain time. Yeah, yeah.
But as you are probably quite familiar, forests and the natural systems, natural spaces are not in stasis.
Mm-hmm.
They are not just not doing anything. They're
right.
constantly changing and evolving. Species grow up, and oh my gosh, is Casey about to wrap this back into his tree?
Wow.
Yes. Our tree today.
He did it.
I want to wrap up the plot. Yes. All the kids are crying in their classrooms right now. It's like watching someone go to the moon.
I take my hat off in disbelief. So watch the shuttle rise into the sky.
So if we preserve the spaces right now that are growing incense cedars. An incense cedar is a tree that grows in mostly drier spaces. So if we are growing them up, you see where I'm going with this?
I do. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to.
No. Please. I appreciate that.
Yeah, please.
I hope everyone else out there is like, oh,
yeah. Please continue.
If a fire comes through,
kills
them, then they are no longer there. And now we are preserving a space that used to be a forest that is now regrowing.
Mm-hmm.
Have we preserved a forest or have we preserved a space that is going to be a forest again?
Right.
Here's another example. This is a tree that grows in full sun. It does not prefer shady areas. If you plant it, or rather if it's growing in a forest area, and there is a, let's say, Shasta red fir growing right next to it, and a white fir that's growing right next to it. These are both more shade-tolerant species that over time would grow up and take over the dominant space and then end up shading out incense cedars.
Okay.
So then, if there are no fires, the incense cedars conceivably will kick the bucket because they're going to get shaded out, forest succession is going to take over, and you're going to have the dominant tree species take over the whole forest canopy. This could take 500 years.
Yeah.
So it's very unlikely that we're not going to have a fire. It's very unlikely that we're not going to have a fire. But let's just say, because people recently have been, pretty good over the last couple hundred years, thank Gifford, stopping forest fires. So all this to say, if we are preserving the incense cedar, then in order to preserve the incense cedar, we need to manage the land to preserve the spaces and the existing trees where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Great. But hold on. If we're managing something, is that preserving it the way that it is, the way that it should be? And how are we deciding the way that it is, the ways that it should be?
Right.
And if we're not going to have any humans in there whatsoever, then what about the management of Native Americans? And this is something I think we can give John Muir a pass on. I don't think he was of a time that they understood. I mean, Christ, we're barely at that time today of understanding and acknowledging the role that Native peoples across the entirety of the continent played in the landscape that we saw when we first had colonizers come over and say, well, look at these beautiful park-like areas. This is very convenient.
Right.
It's like, well, that wasn't just like the trees didn't happen to magically grow like that. So you had this kind of these circular things that we have kind of coming up against. We can preserve something, but what exactly are we preserving it? To what ideal are we choosing and why? And B, if there are no people there, then are we actually preserving it, or is it just like transitioning to the next thing?
Sure.
You know, like I it's kind of hard to even dive into it even further.
I feel like there needs to be a third goalpost here that's like not conservation, not preservation, but like a third thing.
Yeah.
And it's like nobody, build a medieval wall around this forest with no gates and just walk away.
Wow. And just let it do whatever it's going to do.
Because preservation, obviously, you need, like you said, you need some management. And then like how much management until, when do you say, well, we're no longer preserving it, we're like managing it and conserving it.
Exactly, because if you're preserving it, then theoretically you should preserve that space to do whatever that space is going to do, like you're saying, with this wall around it.
Including having a forest fire.
Exactly.
Then do you go in and put out the fire? Well, then you're not really preserving, because fire is a natural part of the landscape.
Natural part of the landscape.
And it's only after we started fighting fires where we thought, were demonized forest fires.
Yeah, in the people who started them most of the time.
Interesting, Casey.
Yeah. So the
I think I get where you're going.
Yeah.
John Muir and Gifford Pinchot, white devils.
Thank you, Alex. I'm glad you finally said it.
That's been our discussion on the incense cedar.
Well, essentially that's kind of the end of it. Where with these two ethics that these people have come up with, the questions really become what exactly is the right one, you know? And if we are preserving something like a wilderness area, which is by far my favorite places to go in the entirety of our like national system of land use, I like them because they don't have any roads in them. You're not going to hear any cars. There's nobody that's going to be driving a gigantic bus-sized RV through them and playing music and laughing and turning on their generators. I don't want anyone laughing in my wilderness areas.
It's where we can go where it really feels like nature.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And there are some people who have even argued fly airplanes around them. And is it ethical to save somebody who's gone into a wilderness area by flying a helicopter in.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Hey, I'm not making an argument one way or another, but I'm just saying people are, this is a discussion. Like, how far are we going to take this?
Yeah.
Do you want to make this wilderness a wilderness?
It's important that John Muir existed.
Yes.
And thought the way that he thought, because in history, if history teaches us something, it is that for things to change, you need radical people who are like the fucking anarchists, you know, who are like, no, you're so, you know, everybody's doing it wrong and you don't even have an idea of how to do it right. Where you might go, well, geez, that's pretty fucking extreme. But without that extreme, we can't take just a half step back and say, well, what if we kind of met halfway, which is still progress.
Yeah.
Right. So John Muir brought us progress, even though he had some pretty fucking extreme ideas.
Yeah.
Which we need in this world, Casey.
I think that is a very good way to wrap that up.
Yeah.
Because I think that is that pretty much gives us a nice little bow on top of it to say, rather to kind of leave it to everybody else to really have this discussion of what is the right method. And if the right method, if there is not the right method, then what is the right methods and how are those balanced with each other? And I think we're trying as the United States of America today to really figure out what that balance is. What should be a wilderness area? What should be conserved forest area for many, many, many different uses? What should be area that has a specific industrial use for whatever it is that we're trying to use it for, whether that's logging for our trees or for something else? So we have these kind of that big side of it where it's on a spectrum, but I don't like necessarily using the spectrum. I almost like having more of a pyramid of idealism, maybe.
Okay.
But then that still, like, it does leave certain things and people out, where if we have this, the very tippy top, like I said earlier, if that is the national park, then should that national park be able to be used by people who have had their ancestors historically use that space for something?
Right.
Shouldn't that be included in that? Or are we preserving it just after the native peoples got kicked out and just before we turned it into an industrial forest?
Well, Casey, I'm very, very glad that you and I are not the decision makers on this. Although maybe we should be. Casey, I'd like to end this discussion with a quote from John Muir.
All right. Yeah, yeah.
In every walk with nature, one receives far more than he seeks.
How beautiful.
And of course, I found this quote painted on the side of a bathroom at Disneyland California Adventure. That was our discussion of the Incense Cedar.
Geez.
We got to take a break, but we will be right back with Completely Arbitrary.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Casey, it is time to review this tree, and here's how it works. We're going to give some final thoughts on this tree, or some initial thoughts, and then give it a rating of 0 to 10 golden cones of honor. Casey is a resident preservationist. We will start with you.
Thank you, Alex. It so happens that this tree, I believe, should be preserved and conserved.
Nice.
Mostly the big ones that are amazing and the places where they are currently growing that are already protected or in like national forest areas that really haven't been cut, I think we should keep those just the way they are. this is my big thought about preservation versus conservation, where I think we need a little bit of everything everywhere. We are going to have a discussion on the ethics of preservation, but that's going to be a side project that we're going to put on our Patreon.
Cool.
Or whatever subscription service we use.
Oh.
And so that is something that's going to have to wait. You're going to have to find that elsewhere. However, we did touch on it enough to where I think I can safely say that there's a spectrum of maybe a hierarchy of what it should be.
Yeah.
And this tree, the incense cedar, I think specifically, should be used in both in some specific ways. The areas that it is growing down in southern Oregon, the Siskiyous, these places where the trees have never been cut and they're massive, big, giant, beautiful things, those need to be retained and saved forever. They're incredible. The cool. trees will blow your mind.
These are those like 15-foot diameter trees.
Yeah, yeah, okay. the big giant ones. Maybe not quite 15 feet. That might be
it's like 30 or 40 feet.
Yeah, it's essentially, it's bigger than the redwoods.
Wow.
Yeah, you heard it here. but then, this is also a tree that many people don't know, was used heavily for pencils. This is a very classic Dixon Ticonderoga number 2 pencil.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's that. All right. It is that wood. So whenever you have that wood, the kind of softness of it, the mm-hmm. smell of it, the cedary smell.
That's an incense cedar.
It's an incense cedar, exactly. Cool.
What about mechanical pencils? Are those also Ooh, incense cedar?
It is not. Those are not actually, Alex. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Incense polymer?
Yeah, it's an incense polymer. They just put a little bit of oil, a little bit of essential oil in there. It smells great. So these trees are like, they're really good. They're useful. They are decay resistant. They have beautiful wood. They are soft wood, so it's easy to work with.
Yeah.
And it is just a lovely decay resistant piece for the things that you use like cedar chests for, you know, like it has that scent, that smell that keeps moths away,
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So they're a tree that should be preserved in certain instances, should be conserved and used in other instances. And gosh dang it, it's just a beautiful tree.
Wow.
They do so well in the urban area because they are drought tolerant. They can take a wide range of soils. And they're, of course, evergreen conifers that are native to our region. So they're adapted to the climate writ large.
I feel like you're gearing up for a high score here.
I might be gearing up for a high score. They're just, every time I see one, like when I first saw the biggest ones I've ever seen, it just blew my mind. Mm. And I was like, I didn't even know they got this big. Yeah. Oh my God. So the incense cedar, I think I'm going to give an 8.8.
Wow.
Right there.
Very
right there,
nice.
Almost at the top. You know, they don't get quite so extraordinary as like a cowrie or a really wild species of ancient other tree. Mm-hmm. So I can't quite push it up too high.
But they're in that upper, what do we say? In the middle of the upper half or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, yeah. They're in that percentile that everyone's respecting, but yeah. doesn't quite drop your jaw.
Totally.
You know? Now, whenever you see one out in the wild, go give it a hug. Whenever you see one in urban area, give it a big thumbs up. Like they're good trees. We should plant more of them in our region. I don't know how well they'll do outside of the Pacific Northwest mm-hmm. or kind of the California floristic province.
Sure.
But spectacular trees. I highly recommend you go find them. And don't smell their leaves thinking, oh, the incense cedar, this is going to smell really good. Don't do that. They don't actually smell that great.
The wood is the thing that smells good, right?
The wood smells good.
Yeah.
The branches themselves are kind of how do I put this? They're the used up portion. You know, like you get like a nice thing. It smells really good, but you have to chop it up and you're like, okay, it's like the cow's milk where you have the cream, mm-hmm. which is the really good stuff. And you have the milk and then you have whatever's left over at the bottom when you like kind of dump all the milk out.
The whey or something.
Yeah. Or it's like, I
understand what you're saying, Casey.
If you understand, then everyone else out there must understand as well. It's not bad, but it's not the good you want.
To quote Jerry Seinfeld, if it moves this along, yeah.
yes. Yeah. We're moved along. We're moved along. That's my thoughts on the incense cedar, Alex.
Wonderful.
Do you have any opinions to share?
Well, I didn't know that they were used to make Ticonderoga pencils, and I am a massive, massive fan of all writing utensils.
Really?
Especially number two Ticonderogas.
What about those comically large ones?
I love them.
Okay.
The ones that you would use for like, you would buy a teacher as kind of a gag gift.
Yeah, yeah. Or like you would fill out one of those giant checks with.
Oh, you have to use a giant pen.
That's my assumption, right? Is that?
I feel like I've seen a sketch like that where they're going to sign a giant check and they have to bring in a giant pen.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, I love any tree that smells good. I love false cedars, Casey.
Oh, really?
I think we should just take it back and be like, these are no longer false cedars. These are just like cypresses or whatever. Wow. Like or what have you.
What take?
I saying something as a false something is immediately makes it feel less like interesting or valuable than the real one.
That's a very good point.
They are a real version of themselves.
They are a real tree.
Yeah, they're trees. So I do think we should think about that. The overall form of it I think is just okay. I think big false cedars are kind of just okay looking as an entire tree.
Interesting.
A little moppy, a little, here and there.
You like them overall, but you think their form is just okay.
I think so, yeah. Okay. So for that reason, I'm going for a 7.25.
7.25.
Which I think is also very respectable.
It really is. It's respectable. 7.25.
It's no 5.
7.25.
That's right.
All right.
That was our review of the incense cedar. It is time for our completely arbitrary Q&A. This one comes from Emily, Case.
Hello, Emily.
Emily says, do you know of any good tree-related citizen science projects that tree enthusiasts could get involved with? Thank you. I'm imagining there's a website that's like Naturalist or something.
Yeah, iNaturalist.
Is that a thing?
It is.
Is that what this is?
That is the first thing that came to my mind, okay. Yes. There's quite a few. Where exactly Emily is at, they may change or they may exist, they may not. But nationally, internationally, iNaturalist is one that I highly recommend. It is a online database where experts and lay people of all sorts will take pictures of a plant, a tree, an animal, you name it. And it will, when you upload that photo rather, the website will take the exact location data that is captured along with your individual shot. And it will say, oh, great. Yeah, we can actually confirm this picture was taken right here. So we know that this animal was spotted right here.
Interesting.
And then that will help scientists basically figure out what are the ranges of different plants and animals, how do they change, and where are we seeing these today? Because not everyone's going to be out scientifically looking at all these different plants. However, some of them may be something that nobody knew about. They took a picture of an interesting tree and say, hey, look at this cedar. And then someone looks at it and they're like, oh my God, that's a cedar that shouldn't be there. No one knew that was growing
there.
Then they can either expand the range or find that there's a unique population that still exists, things like that.
The next great discovery could be
there.
An upload away.
Exactly. Or the great discovery of like, whoa, we didn't even know it was on these mountains.
Yeah, exactly. This is basically like a user-generated database.
Yeah.
Of locations of plants and animals.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. And then it's usually also perused by experts who go through and say, no, that's actually this tree, it's actually that tree, it's this bird, it's that bird.
Oh, it's like Wikipedia has editors.
To an extent, yeah, okay. But I don't think it's anyone can just edit it. I think it has to be someone particular.
I think Wikipedia is the same way.
Yeah, and they also, these experts will say that you can, they'll say that's like science grade is what they call it, or research grade, I think. So if you take a picture that's good enough that is very clearly identifiably this thing, they'll call it research grade. And that way it gets the mark that says that scientists can actually use that where it's valid enough and sure enough that they can say, yes, this is a scientifically accurate data point that you may use elsewhere. There's one great example.
Yeah.
The other one that comes to mind is one that, like, say, Hoyt Arboretum and volunteers get involved with. And it's called, I think it's like Operation Budbreak or something like that. And it's essentially a citizen scientist opportunity for people to get involved with the phenology of a certain ecosystem. So, for instance, they say in Hoyt, when do these particular plants first break their buds and put out new leaves or flowers or whatever it is? Then you go out and you constantly walk around, you look at these trees and you say, it happened this day at this time, or usually not this time, just this day.
Mm.
And that way they can track when different plants are doing different things and how their yearly cycles can kind of shift over the decades, so that we know phenology, or rather the phenology of this space and how it's changing with, say, climate change or something like that.
Phenology being the cycle of pollination and flowering and...
Yeah, not necessarily pollination, just the seasonal changes in plants.
That's what I meant and meaning to say.
Gotcha, Then you are spot on.
No.
Aside from that, there are lots of opportunities that people can get involved with through a lot of independent local things, and a lot of them are like identifying mushrooms or just uploading data to a certain database if you find something.
Mm.
But there are so many and so varied that I can't really give you any good examples. But the best thing that I could recommend is reaching out to an extension service in your area, reaching out to a professional or local group, like a mycological group or something like that. And they will say, yeah, we're actually just collecting data, or they know who is collecting data and they can kind of connect you. So it'll take just a little bit of sleuthing, but once you find it, you'll be able to figure out what they want, how they want it. And then you can add your observations to their data sets.
Interesting. I'm assuming there are a lot of these different things, and there's a spectrum of locality. Like, some are probably really hyper local.
Yeah.
You know, maybe for like an arboretum, or then there's like iNaturalist, which is like
whole world,
worldwide.
Yeah, exactly.
How about this? Calling an arboretum.
Yeah.
And asking about this.
Definitely be like, hey, is there anything, do you guys have any projects like this?
Yeah.
I just want to get involved and get outside. Yeah. Go meet some trees.
That'd be fun. That'd be a fun kind of hobby.
Yeah, right.
Or take pictures of trees for iNaturalist.
Exactly. And a lot of people get really into it because it also helps people identify it. So if you post something on iNaturalist and say, hey, what is this? I think that some people can comment and say, this is actually this variety or this species. So you can get like as very specific as you ever want.
That's great.
But I highly encourage you just exploring out there for that. I know a lot of universities are really looking for this because they don't have the funding always to put the data out there, to get the data that is out there.
Yeah.
So anyone who's willing to help, as long as they can ensure it's of a certain quality, then they're usually into it.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. Well, thank you, Emily, for that very interesting question.
There you are.
If you've got a question for us, join up on the Patreon, patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
Mm-hmm.
If you'd like to support this podcast, the Patreon's the best way. The Cone of the Month Club. Every month you get cone stickers of different species illustrated by a different artist every month. This month, it is November. This month we have the Sugi.
Yeah, we do.
Cryptomeria japonica.
It's so gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Otherwise known as the Japanese cedar, if you are out here. But it's the same kind of cedar as our incense cedar.
Wow.
Is it a cedar? No.
Japanese hyphen cedar?
Yeah, you can do that. You can do that. It's cool. In its own... monotypic genus, but it's in the cypress family.
Oh, whew, gosh. Nice.
Almost really.
I'm glad you were in charge of that, not me.
Yeah, me too. Holy hell.
If you get to the end of your month and you realize that the education, hopefully the entertainment, although that jury's still out, that we gave you that month is worth $5, $10, consider joining the Patreon and supporting this podcast. Every dollar goes back into making the podcast. And we really appreciate all of our supporters all across the globe.
Yes, we do. And we want you to be one of them.
We would adore to have you. Casey Clapp.
Alex Krosen.
We have a very special theme month coming up.
We do.
But this concludes our little mini theme, our little Fortnite theme on conservation and yes. preservation.
I like doing Fortnite themes.
I do too.
I just like using the term Fortnite.
It is now synonymous with the video game, unfortunately.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
I can't hear those words and not think the video game.
Bad. Well, then let's say it enough till it breaks that.
I think we could be the ones to take it down, Casey.
I think we can. The only thing I always think, well, I just generally like the term.
Yeah.
But I always think about the old comedian Dimitri Martin. You remember that guy?
I sure do.
Well, he had a joke one time. He said, you know, whenever something happens, I wait 2 weeks to tell someone about it so I can use the term Fortnite.
Nice.
And I just like, Dimitri Martin, you're so, so boring. And I love it so much.
Wonder where he is now.
I don't know, drawing circles with both hands at the same time, I assume.
That's right.
God, he's going places.
And with that, we say thank you so much for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary. We will see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye. Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Clapp.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barthold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.